The following program may contain content that your kids would love to hear, but you may not want them to.
Tell you, one of my writers, Frank Cotola, just finished 3 years of tracing his roots. Yeah, he went back and forth to Italy and through the whole Mediterranean into the hills of Sicily and through every inch in Naples, and he did it. He finally found his mom and dad. Actually, it would have taken a lot less time if they hadn't been running away from him at the time.
Knucklehead. Say, Jerry left already. You better hurry, you'll be late for school.
Oh, I ain't going to school, Mr. Winkle.
Oh, you two? Listen, Knuck, let's talk about it, shall we? What is it?
Oh, it ain't no use, sir. They can't teach me nothing.
Knucklehead, They can't teach me anything.
Oh, you must be stupid too, huh?
Look, what seems to be the trouble?
Well, it's all this here homework I gotta do.
Oh, let me see it.
Yeah, right here.
Oh, well, they just want you to write a composition about George Washington.
Mm-hmm.
You know who George Washington was?
Oh, certainly. He used to stand like this.
No, that was Napoleon.
No, Washington.
Knucklehead, when did Washington ever stand like that?
When he was wearing itchy underwear.
Oh, look, why don't we try a little simpler subject? Now tell me, how are you with arithmetic?
Oh, great. Just terrific. There's only one thing I don't know.
What's that?
What's arithmetic?
All right, we'll do something very, very easy. Now tell me, how much is one and one?
Could you give me a hint?
All right. Hold up a finger.
Okay.
How much is that?
One.
Now hold up another finger.
Okay.
And how much is that?
11.
Just put down one finger.
All right.
Now, what have you got?
I got a hangnail. Have you got a scissors, sir? Oh, please.
Oh, knucklehead, you're completely exasperating, frustrating, and incorrigible.
Gee, I wish you'd tell it to my mother. She thinks I'm a jerk.
Oh, no.
Oh, it's no use, Mr. Winkle. I'm hopeless.
Oh, don't say that, knucklehead. Nobody is hopeless. Look, let me tell you a little story. I once knew three fellows.
Yeah?
And, well, they weren't too bright, but they were gas station attendants, you see.
Uh-huh.
Well, one day, a big car pulled up for... Pow! Pow! Pow!
We'll be right back. the way it should be.
One, two, three, hit it!
Rock the show. Time to lay down some serious sound.
Here we go again!
Katola, Katola.
Shake that thing.
Good God!
Work it. Work it. Shake that thing.
Katola, Katola.
Cthulhu Chronicles.
Knuckleheads everywhere. Hither and be merry, because the Bard of Broadcasting is now on the air again. Neo postmodernists, he sunburnt a sickleman make holiday. Wake up, it's night. Philosophical entertainment, relevant irreverence, netterati, couple surface, netaholics, and infomaniacs. Time to be curious, yellow. Y2K plus 13. From Ice Cap to Ice Cap, from Hamlet to City, from Othello and into every bordello. If you think it's getting late, my friends, it's later than you think. Helmets and face masks are not required. Here we are, once again, in the old corral, as they say out there in the... I wouldn't know, I'm not a cowboy. But as a little kid, I used to want to be a cowboy. I had a cowboy hat and the thing and the holster and stuff. And we have a show for you that is beyond a comparison, because who would compare it with anything, okay? Mr. Jonathan Geffner, who's been on here before, this world-renowned and very talented ventriloquist. And how many people do you know that can put on their tax form, occupation, ventriloquist? I guess you just put entertainer or what have you, but you do. And that's why I played in the collage. And something I noticed, I'm going to tell you about. I played in the collage, one of the greats of my growing up time, in my childhood, Paul Winchell, with one of my favorite dummies, Knucklehead. Knucklehead. here's what's wild about this, and I hadn't realized that Knucklehead, in this clip, it's a clip, okay? You just heard the voice track, the soundtrack of the clip. But in the clip, Knucklehead has, he's talking about school, he has a notebook, and you'll never guess. Oh, yeah, you will guess now, right? Yes, this is like from the late 50s or mid, it's a Mead notebook. He has an official Cthulhu Chronicles notebook right there in that clip. So that's wild. And I told you, it's one of the unchanging things of in life. Although there are many, it's one of the ones that is certainly visual and obvious, is that Mead notebook. And I don't get paid by Mead. I just tell you that this is a great notebook. It's a great way to keep your notes and write things down and use it when you listen to this show, because we make so many annotations. Now, aside from everything else, and I'm always serious, so I'm not going to say I'm going to get serious now, but last week we mentioned that we would like to have all of your hopes and prayers or whatever it is you do that sends out good feelings, or that just having good feelings for Mr. Rick Busby, who, of course, is the man from Ronette Radio and Final Frontier Radio, and I've been on radio with him many times, and he's been on there, and, of course, we should know Rick. He's the guy who does the License to Skill commercial that we run here. A man who, for some reason or another, has called me the man, the myth, the legend. I don't know why, but I certainly do appreciate it. We told you that Rick was in the hospital and recovering, we see signs of recuperation. But it does not look good. And I don't want to date this show at all, but I just want to hope that everybody go to Final Frontier Radio, send in emails, go to Rick Busby's, Rick Busby, B-U-S-B-Y, go to his Facebook page, write in, Get Better Rick, do whatever you have to do, because Rick is fighting for his life, even as we speak right now. And this is the great universe to live in all the time, all of us, where someone is able to sit here with this cloak of greatness that somebody else has given them, and I don't deserve it. I think the man who is fighting for his life is the man with the courage, and we hope that Rick will recover in all ways, shapes, and forms. Because he's a great guy, and he's an attribute to alternative broadcasting, and we send out our best to him. We're going back to Jonathan. We're going to get Jonathan Geffner. I say going back to, because Jonathan has been on the show before. Trillo and Suede are the two characters that he has developed. And he has a Kickstarter project. We're going to talk about it, so maybe everyone can play a part in this, trying to get a movie going. And thanks to Kim, we'll learn more about Kickstarter too in this, because I was thinking, hey, maybe we should get a Kickstarter to keep this program going and pay for some of the bills. I never did it though, of course. And there are announcements going to be made eventually. And I keep saying this, but, you know, we're getting into deep summer, and things are always changing. As much as they say the same, as much as there's always a Mead notebook, there'll always be the things that change or move on. We have an announcement to make soon about a place where the archives of this show will be available to everybody who constantly asks me about that. Since the demise of Out Loud shows and other various places where we had our archives, we're going to have another place, a special place. We'll be telling you about that soon. Also, For Culture Radio, which I don't know exactly right now how to get to this, but I think it's on beta broadcasting right now, but we're going to have For Culture Radio. For Culture Radio, of course, is related to what is in forculture.com. This is the greatest digital magazine to be created. This is the one 10, 20 years from now there that people are going to say, remember For Culture? They were way ahead of their time. And that's why I am so happy to be a part of that, and I have been since the beginning. You can read exclusive pieces by me, which many of you may like, because you've been kind enough to buy License to Skill and my other publications, Molotov Memoirs, and you go to my blog at Tumblr, Cotolo.tumblr, and all the other places. So I know you will love the original exclusive stories. They don't appear anywhere else but in forculture.com. And get on to the cutting edge of everything that's happening in pop culture. That's what it's all about. And you can, believe me, you read it on your screen, and you can read it on any screen. You got, now we're mobile. And you know, we're moving along. SRN MediaWorks has us mobile. You can listen to Cotolo Chronicles and everything else, all the SRN shows, and anything else you want you could go download your archives when they're there, and go over to the Artist D on Sundays and Saturdays and Mondays and anytime, because there is no real time when it comes to internet broadcasting. We're all over. We're not all over. It's like, it's all over now. It's over, Johnny. It's over. I don't mean it's all over. It's not all over. It's right here. And we are going to continue until forbid. So if you're curious, Yellow, and you want to stay that way, you stay with us right here, because it is night. Wake up. It's night. It's never been more truthful, that phrase. And one of these days, I am going to do and another show on that whole wake up, it's night thing. Now, I was going to do a special show before I remembered. See, because I'm like all over the place with this. As I told you, I never rehearse, but I'm always prepared. And I was thinking, what can I do tonight? I wanted to do a show, and I will still do a show somewhere down the line. A solo show, a drum solo show with just me. Entirely devoted to my dad, stories about my dad, and all sorts of stuff, because, you know, he's become a character. He's kind of he's like a philosophical sidekick in this particular show, my sire. And I wanted to do that, and I was going to do that because it's his birthday. So of course, we're talking about a man who's dead here. He's passed on. I'm going to talk about him, but it is his birthday, and that's why I wanted to do this show. And I'm going to do it one day. Memories of my father, and we'll even read some of the stories that I have written that have been received very well just about everywhere. Because this is a special guy, and he had a special boy, and that's me. And I have special boys, and that's them. But we're going to do that on another time. The Kickstarter thing and Jonathan Geffner is something we've wanted to do more about Kickstarter. So I'd forgotten, is what I'm saying. I'd forgotten that Jonathan, I booked him for this. And so here is not right now. I'm not introducing him. We're going to get Jonathan on Skype, and we're going to be talking to him about more about, we'll reintroduce him to those of you who don't remember Jonathan. And I got to be honest with you, because I'm always trying to be honest with you, except when I'm lying. And that is that there's a lapse in my memory. I don't remember exactly when he was on. It was last year, the year before that. I've lost track. Someone asked me on Facebook the other day, said, how long have you been doing this podcast? And it's amazing how it's called a podcast. You know, people know, I do a podcast. And it's not a podcast. This is a broadcast. It's always been a broadcast. And before there was podcasting, there was Cthulhu Chronicles. There were many shows. I'm not just saying that I was the only talk show. Talk. And the original talk show on internet radio. But it was, you know, I didn't do a podcast. See, podcasts didn't come about until we were able to actually do quick downloading and cable stuff. We were on before that. So I said, and then they were like, you're kidding. No, I'm not kidding. So we shouldn't call things podcasts unless they're podcasts. And a podcast is pre-recorded. It's not live. And just because you can download something afterward doesn't make it a podcast. We do become, like I said, in archives and various, you go to Facebook 30 minutes after this show is live, it's recorded, it's on there, you can download it. So, and soon you'll just go to a special website, which we're going to announce, and you'll go there. But it's not a podcast, because first of all, is anyone really walking around with an iPod anymore? Or has all the stuff that was in an iPod now been incorporated into the mobile mechanics of the phones, the Galaxies, the iPods, the iPads, I don't know anybody who has an iPod anymore that is programming things. So therefore, there's not even podcasts anymore. It's just a show. It's a recording of a show, and this is the show. So if you download it and you get it, but I think it's fascinating because people do that. How long have I been doing this podcast? It's like a podcast. And it's not a podcast because there's no pod and there's no cast. It's just me and whoever is going to be on. But in all events, and certainly in this event, you know what to do and where to go. During the week, all the places you can go you want to be my friend, and many of you do, and I appreciate that. I don't know the limit on friends at Facebook, but I know we're up in the thousands now. So go on over there, Frank Cotolo. You know my name. Look up my number. And be my friend there. Now on there you find wonderful things. Now I'm also tweeting a lot more of the wit and wisdom of Frank Cotolo at Frank Cotolo. See, there's no fooling around with fake names. I'm not Rhinosaurus267 or anything like that. But if you go into a chat room and you see Rhinosaurus627, that is me. I don't know. But you can get me at Twitter. Now, I can't say about Twitter what I said about Facebook, and as I was one of the first, 25 people on Facebook. I don't know. It wasn't that, but it was very early on, okay, before it became the place everybody wanted to go. But on Twitter, I got to admit, I got onto Twitter and left it alone for a long time and then got involved with it in terms of things I do that I get paid to do. And then, of course, to promote my own stuff, thanks to Kurt Brando, who I swear to you, as I keep saying this, is going to be on the show again. We just have to find a way to get him up early enough because he lives in Saudi Arabia. No, well, that isn't Saudi Arabia, is it? It's not Qatar. It's the Isle of Wight. It's, what is it? You know where. Dubai is near there, somewhere around there. Yes, United Arab Emirates, of course. The UAE. It's funny how nobody else is an emirate. Anywhere, I don't know anybody else who uses that, United Arab Emirates. I don't even know. I'm going to have to look that up. I don't even know the exact definition as opposed to definition of Emirates, but we'll look that up. We're going to get Kurt Brando, and he's the one. When he was on here, and this is years ago now too, for those of you who think that we're just doing podcasts. He did a podcast at one time. It was a podcast because it wasn't live. It was just he produced something and it, put it on. And a pristine podcast, I may add, because pays attention to detail anymore. I can't say that because I don't know everybody in the world, but Kurt Brando. But Kurt came on the show. He's always telling us about the cutting edge of things and told us about this place called Twitter where people go and group. And this is before anybody that was a celebrity thought, hey, there's a way I could be remembered. And people can remember me as we go along, because now everybody's on there. Everybody's got to have a Twitter account. So I joined up, and then I just let it. I was dormant for a while. I wasn't. Francis McDormand was also standing still at a certain time, but I didn't do anything until I started to do things, because that's what happens. I don't do anything, and then I start to do things. So I started to do things, and then because I'm a knucklehead, I am very much. Isn't it amazing that the people of whom we identify in our childhood, because I'm the knucklehead, is it? If I was a dummy, I would be knucklehead. Hey, there's another name. Wait, I got to write that down on my list of books names. If I was a dummy, I'm still collecting titles for my book of titles. I got to write it here. Where did I put it? Here. If I were a dummy, here, if I were a dummy, I would be Knucklehead. This is the name of my new book. You see, what I'm doing is eventually, and I don't know if I'll even do this, but I'm collecting, and because I probably missed a billion of them. I'm collecting the book of titles. I'm collecting titles for the book of titles. This would be a list of unwritten books, a list of unwritten book titles that I'll never have enough time in my life to write. So there are, and a lot of them come from phrases which I say on this show that just come out and go, well, that stands out like that. If I were a dummy, I would be Knucklehead. There are other ones. The last couple of weeks ago, Heather Drain was here, and she gave me a title, Having Fun with Mr. Hand. That's going to be another one from the book of titles of books that I could write. And it's unbelievable. My shtick is so good, it works on me. These are just titles that I'm going to, I don't want to tell you about. I was so bored I made pancakes. I love that one. That's one of these books. You know, it's more fun to think about what would be the content of these books if you give the title than it would be to actually read them. I think that's, don't you think? I think so. Oh, I read this book. I was so bored I made pancakes. What a title. It's just, and I love titles. I've always loved titles. And I have, in the past when I'm an ASCAP member and I've written songs and I've gotten paid to write songs and things in the history of my life, which is what, you know, goes back. And I remember, you know, I would come up with a title. I said, there's a title for a song, and a whole song would come out of just knowing the title. Same thing with stories. And all sorts of stuff. I love titles. And I think that's another reason I love Shakespeare has great titles. Not all of them just about characters. You know, Hamlet is Hamlet. Okay, King Lear is King Lear. Okay, but Much Ado About Nothing. Much Ado About Nothing. I wonder if Shakespeare had his own book of titles, and eventually wrote plays based on the titles. I don't know, and I've read a lot about Billy. Billy, you think anybody called him Bill? Hey, Bill! Hey, Bill! Hi, Bill! I guess. Hello to all my friends at Tyne FM and everybody over in England. And to everybody who is listening to the show, remember, please support the stations on the internet that rerun this show. We're all over the place, and you can listen to us at any given time. And now that you have the ability to listen on the road, because you've got everyone's got a mobile now, I wonder if anybody's ever going to have any more inside, you know, big machines like towers and things. Or are people just going to be running around listening and reading and stuff on their iPads and iPhones? And I don't mean iPhone specifically, the Galaxy, the Android. Android, what a great name for a phone. Android. It's like, oh, human. Isn't that what that means? A fake human? Android? I knew a number of them. My name is Frank Cotolo. My man's name adorns the title of the show. Coming up in June, because now we're on the precipice of June, is, of course, more Tom Savino. Savino Cotolo Chronicles. Tom is thinking about something. Let's talk about the series. And I guarantee you, that is not going to be serious for long, whatever we're talking about. We will find the humorous side of it. Also, him and I, he doesn't know this yet, but I'm announcing it right now, we're going to do an entire show on the Tonto joke. And this may coincide with what's going on with the release of the new Johnny Depp movie, which I talked about way years before when he first announced he was doing it and showed his face. Anyway, we're going to do Tonto jokes. And you're going, what is that for? What's a Tonto joke? Forget it. We probably talked about it before, but we're not going to talk about it right now. So Tom Savino will be back, my former partner. And now my partner. He's my partner again, I guess. You know, he's not even a former partner. He's still my partner. Once a partner, always a partner. In certain situations. In other situations, though. But anyway, we're going to be looking for, right now, and I don't know why we don't have him connected, but I guess we'll just call him Mr. Jonathan Geffner, and he'll be on the, and we'll talk about any sorts of, now he'll talk, he could talk, of course, in any number of voices, because he's got them, and being a ventriloquist, we won't know where he's throwing that voice. Because you won't be able to see the fact that his, you won't be able to see that his lips don't move. How do you see that something doesn't move? What does that mean? You see his lips don't move. How do you see something that doesn't move? Is it that you're imagining it should move, but it's not moving, it's making sounds. I don't see his, yeah, it's like being a magician. And that's what it is being a mouth magician is what, that is what a ventriloquist might be called. A mouth musician. Anyway, and then events in all events, and certainly in this event. I do want to do this before we call him. I just want to do this one thing and send out, because we'll always do this. Where is it? Where did it go? Oh, I got to go back to the, because we want to hear this, and because it's just terrific. It's a terrific job no matter what. Buy the book as Rick tells you.
In a world where reading is dying out, a new champion emerges. wacky escapades, parallel universes.
Hello, everyone. This is me, Frank Cotolo.
There's never a dull moment as Frank weaves the tale of a writer making you laugh, chuckle, and learn a bit about life. Pick up License to Skill by Frank Cotolo, now on Amazon for your Kindle.
Now, this is actually a book. Oh, here comes John. This is actually a book which I wrote, so you can. It's not like just a title. So we'll get that. Exactly. What this man has timing. Here comes Jonathan. Timing. Exact. What timing? The man's a ventriloquist, a comedian, a magician. Is it okay, Jonathan, to call? I just thought of this one. A mouth magician. A ventriloquist?
That sounds good. I like that. That's not one of the more common names for it.
I know, a mouth magician. Well, I don't mean it anyway. I mean, I just thought of it right now. It's nice to see you, Will. No one else can see you, but I can, and I appreciate that. I'm sorry I don't have a cam.
So you see me now, huh? This Skyping thing is, I don't do very often, but we got through. You got through.
Yeah, I did a regular call, and I got a video call, but that's okay. I don't mind looking. If you don't mind, my eyes on you while your eyes aren't on me. I'm like your dummy.
Oh, that's true. I guess I'm used to winging these things. So you don't, you're not going to give me the benefit of a video link, huh? You don't do that.
There's a couple of reasons we don't do that, and it doesn't really matter. But, I mean, this is, for all due purposes, a radio show. The minute we start getting into visuals, we're not a radio show anymore, see?
Ah, okay, that's so true. I thought maybe we'll have a...
I wish we could, in this sense, because you could be do some stuff, but I don't even have the capability of doing it, to be honest with you. I don't even know how to do it.
How to do what? Ventriloquism?
No, obviously I don't know ventriloquism. No, I don't even know. How would I just suddenly say, hey, hit in the video? I don't know how to do that.
Okay. No, I thought I'd sort of give you a show here, and then you could sort of relate to the audience what you're saying. Nah, I guess that won't be too exciting.
Well, we did this before, and we made a joke about it, saying, how would you know? And I was just making a joke about it because how would you know his lips aren't moving even when you see it, because how could you know? How could you be looking for something that doesn't happen?
Right. Well, there is a precedent for this about ventriloquism on the radio. The famous Edgar Bergen, famous ventriloquist from the 1920s,
yes.
30s, 40s. So he had a famous, very popular radio show.
Right.
Way back. You probably know that already.
I do. Yes. Yeah. But we'll tell everyone else.
And that, of course. Is ironic since ventriloquist on the radio is a strange concept. But actually, in his case, that's assumed to be the reason that his technique became rather poor spent a few years on the radio, because he got so sloppy, because he realized, well, people can't see what I'm doing anyway. So his lips started to move a lot. Then when he did live shows, his technique wasn't so good anymore.
You know, I hear the same thing happen to the guys on radio who played Amos and Andy.
Uh-huh. Oh. they stopped looking black anymore.
I know people we introduce a lot of people. We have a younger audience, and we introduce a lot of people to things. During the collage in the beginning of the show, I played a piece with Paul Mitchell and his my favorite dummy he had, Knucklehead.
Ah, yes. Paul Winchell was my greatest inspiration.
Oh, I did not even know that.
Yes, I kind of modeled myself after him as I was learning ventriloquism. He was my favorite. He had a kind of energy, a kind of vitality, excitement invading. And his dummies were very, very alive. You know, both technically, he was really an excellent ventriloquist, but he also had the personalities he brought to life. You know,
well, you're right about him being a great technician. Do you know that Paul Winchell, and you could check, anybody can check this. He had the patent, of course. He developed the first artificial heart.
Yes, I know about that. Yeah. I read that. He even wrote a not very well-known little autobiography at one point, and got a hold of a copy there. And he talks about it there.
Fascinating.
So he's quite an amazing person. It's, talent comes in different, you know, way clusters, I guess.
Yeah. Well, so are you, and I've seen a lot of your stuff, and I can vouch for your talents, and I've watched your videos and everything, and I love you have one. What's his name? Schmedlick, Schmenken. What's his name?
Schmendrick.
Schmendrick. You know, it's amazing. Well, I love this because it's a word that a friend of mine, when I was living in Los Angeles, a very good friend of mine who's passed, used to use that term. I guess, is that an old Jewish term or something?
Yeah, it's a Yiddish word.
It is. Okay. Okay.
Yes. It means a mischief or a rascal. It could be translated as a jerk. You know, it has different connotations, but I like to think of it in a less offensive kind of meaning. The definition of just as being like a rascal kind of guy, mischievous guy. Yeah, but my father used to call me a Schmendrick when I was a kid, so I didn't feel he meant it in too abusive a way.
No.
Like the milder form, like, you know, someone who's very mischievous. So that's in the sense I use it.
Well, I wonder if I like knucklehead, because my father used to call me a bonehead, you know?
Close enough.
Schmendrick, I guess, could be your knucklehead, though. Is that correct?
Well, in a sense, but I have quite a few cast of characters. Are you still there, Frank?
Oh, yeah, I'm here. Yeah,
we're fine. I have this little Skype sound thingy that
yeah, I heard it. Maybe it meant somebody was giving you a comment or something, but go ahead.
Oh, okay. So Schmendrick is a kind of nervous character, he's kind of a little different, because Knucklehead Smith is this more whimsical, carefree guy.
You're right. It was Knucklehead Smith. They actually had a last. That's right.
I have another character who is more similar. My character Ezra, the blonde sort of hillbilly guy, and he's more modeled after Knucklehead Smith, more inspired by him. You know, like a very whimsical, carefree kind of guy. Each one of my puppets has, I guess, aspects of me, but some are more like what I am, and some are more what I would like to be, latent parts.
When you mentioned the Edgar Bergen thing, I was just wondering to myself, right now, if you were to do, because nobody's watching you, if you were to do Schmendrick or those, would you, you wouldn't move your lips, even if no one's watching it, right? Because that's what you do, right?
Well, normally, yeah, but, you know, I can sort of differentiate that in my mind. When I'm sort of aware, subconsciously at least, about whether I'm doing ventriloquist for an audience, whether people are watching or not. So, you know, I'm certainly capable of doing it with moving my lips and just doing the voices. It's just another form of voice technique. But you know, I could do it that way. But it's true. I think what you're getting at is true, that it feels weird to me. Like if I'm moving my mouth, I just feel like that's sort of not the way his voice is supposed to go. Like, you know, it's supposed to be done ventriloquially. That I feel
ventriloquially. I like that. It's supposed
to be done
ventriloquially. I like that. I like that a lot. Do you have you ever, when you were when you were learning, when you were developing honing the art, the science of doing this? Did you ever go into a restaurant and make like somebody else is ordering coffee or something? Did you ever do anything like that, or toss your voice in a fun kind of a rascally way yourself?
I did it sometimes with friends. You know, I never felt comfortable about doing it to strangers for some reason. I just felt it sort of cheating, or I don't know. I was uncomfortable about doing that. You know, not that it's necessarily a terrible thing to do, but I play tricks on friends like that sometimes, yes. But through the years, I do it less and less, because I do so many shows, and I have done so many shows through the 28 years or so that I've been doing it, that professionally. So after so many thousands of shows that I've lost count, you know, I kind of differentiate in my mind pretty much. Like either when I'm not performing, I tend to want to get my mind away from it, generally. But I'm very happy to talk about opportunities like this to sort of re-examine it and think about it again. It's fun. But as far as just like playing around with it when I'm not performing, you know, as a general rule, I don't feel inclined to do that.
What I'm always fascinated, and I've done this with myself, and I've talked to other people about it, and I guess I don't know why. It's just a little thing I have, but I'm always fascinated at why people are attracted to certain things, especially creative people. I mean, you turn out to be a ventriloquist as opposed to a magician. Oh, did we lose you?
Oh.
I just lost you.
I see a little icon there for video. Did you you want to see?
It's okay if you don't want to keep the video on.
Because I figured for just talking.
Yeah, it's okay.
It is after all radio, isn't it?
So yes, it is. So take it off. Okay.
Yeah.
What can go back to the earliest moment that you can recall that you were enthralled or it embraced you, this particular thing, this of ventriloquism? Why do you think you have this affinity? Like, I got an affinity for writing and a lot of things, you know, doing other stuff and talking and stuff. Where did it hit you? How young were you, and why do you think it happened?
Well, it sort of hit me in stages. When I was a kid, I had no plan to become a ventriloquist, and I didn't become one until I was a young adult. As a kid, I was a big fan of the Paul Winchell shows, the different permutations of that show. It started in the 50s and went through the 60s. And, the Jerry Mahoney, Paul Winchell, Jerry Mahoney Hour, and they had other names for it, I forget. But anyway, from time to time, you know, through those years, my early years, I watched his shows, and I just loved it. I mean, I was very fascinated and inspired about it, but somehow it didn't occur to me that I could become a ventriloquist. So I didn't really pursue it or try to find out how one could learn to do that. So that was sort of on the back burner in my brain for many years. Meanwhile, I did other things, a lot of creative things. I was a pianist, a series pianist for a number of years.
Yes, I remember you. Yes. Yeah,
yeah, so I did that, and I got into other pursuits, too, with the acting and comedy writing and teaching, improv, various things, like martial arts. There's a lot of stuff I got into. But ventriloquism, finally, it just hit me. There was a moment, and actually it was a momentous day. Can't forget this one, because I had enrolled in a doctoral program in piano, so a PhD program in piano at NYU, after getting a master's degree in piano from Patton School of Music. So I enrolled in that, and it was my first semester there. I was just a few weeks into it, and I was sort of traumatized by the program. I realized quickly that I don't want to do this. It was so much research involved rather than playing the piano as the main thing. So, and I'm not a research type of guy. I figured, so I felt like this is not the program for me. So I abruptly dropped out. And it was, I remember the day that I dropped out, the morning I dropped out, I was walking around aimlessly in Manhattan, just trying to come to grips with what I'm going to do with my life now. And I sort of wandered into Columbus Circle in Manhattan, and I saw a ventriloquist there. The first time I had seen a live ventriloquist performing, and I was so enthralled by that, and I had these memories flooding back to me of Paul Winchell from my childhood, and I was thinking, why did I not think of that? This is what I need to do. This is what I was meant to do. I just felt like it was a calling or something. So that was a great moment of inspiration. Then I just made it my main goal in life to become a ventriloquist, to find out how this can be done, how I could do it, and no matter what it takes, I'm going to do it. So within a year from then, from that day, I was a professional ventriloquist.
Wow. I was thinking that you were going to say that you were going to tell the story like this. So I'm walking along wondering what I'm going to do with my, and suddenly I said to myself, and because you said to yourself, but I guess it didn't work out like that.
A clever way to present it. Next time I tell the story, I'll borrow your line.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, change the story every now and then, because, you know, the more popular you get tired of hearing the same questions all the time. Change the story. And because, you know, when the truth is not interesting, print the legend. That's, but I like that story though. I mean, of walking, and I used to work in an office right near Columbus Circle. So I know the area very well. I was mugged there too once.
Your memories are different from mine, not as positive.
I have a lot of positive memories. The mugging was just one day. The rest of the time was, I had a lot of fun there. But I like that story. That's a great story that you were suddenly, and I was right. I said, how did this embrace you? It just grabbed you then at that particular point.
Yeah, really did. It's kind of, there are cliches about, there is some cliche about bad things coming out of, good things coming out of bad. So it's like, that's what happened really, because I was at a low point in my life. And, if it wasn't for that, for being at a low point, I may not have had the determination to pursue it, because I felt at that point, I've got nothing to lose. I don't know what I want to do. I've done all kinds of things, but just making a living, scrounging for a living by doing various things in music and a comedy and teaching stuff, various things. So then I figured, I'm not married, don't have kids, I really have no responsibilities except to myself. So what the hell? Let's go for it. Let's see if I can do this. So it worked out in that way.
Yeah, you and I have a lot in common in that respect, because we've done a whole bunch of things, and even professionally, and just skipped around, and it was very hard to settle. And I think that a lot of creative people who have the ability to do a number of things have a difficulty focusing on any one particular thing. For instance, I'm sure you still, you still play the piano. And if somebody said, "Hey, will you play the piano somewhere?" and they gave you some bucks, you'd play the piano because you're a great pianist.
I can play.
You don't stop playing the piano because now you can throw your voice.
Yeah, but actually, in my case, I pretty much stopped for a number of years, and then I did get back to it in recent years. For me, it was a kind of thing where I was reacting to having taken it so seriously for my youth, and I kind of just wanted to escape it. I thought of it too much as an all or nothing thing. And I'm not recommending people do this, because it's not a good way to look about it or think about something that you love.
Exactly.
So for music, I feel, I'm not going to be a concert pianist. I decided that route is not for me. It's just too much of a total life commitment to try to do that. I just sort of couldn't stand playing at a less than very high level. So I just kind of gave it up. But that's not good. At some point in recent years, after my first daughter was born, in fact, she's 16 now, is when I started to play again, because I started to realize, this is stupid. I still love music and I still can play the piano, so what if I'm not at the highest concert level? Who cares, So I got back to playing.
I don't see any reason why it doesn't find a place somewhere on your itinerary as a creative person. Sure. I mean, and it's a gift regardless of how, and I know that because I'm what is known as a bad piano player, but I do, and I love to sit down and just, pound away. But without it, as much as, and now you know this too, I'm sure, it's like you could not do something for a while, but if somebody came and took it away from you forever and it wasn't long an option, you would suddenly go, oh, geez, I want that back,
Sometimes that's a good wake up call for someone, to realize that, take advantage. Life goes by and you never know how many chances you get to do something. So, appreciate it.
We're going to talk about, and the first time you were on, we talked about the fact that you were trying to get a movie going, and that you are, and there's links, of course, if everybody went to the blog and what have you, there's links to go to YouTube and get a taste of what Trillo and Suede, or is it Suede and Trillo or Trillo and Suede?
Trillo and Suede.
Yeah, Trillo and Suede. Isn't it funny how those... I mean, I said Suede and Trillo, and I knew it was wrong. How something sounds correct even if you don't know which way.
I'm glad it struck you that way, because the way it sounds, it seems to flow to me.
It's like nobody would say Lewis and Martin or Costello and Abbott. It has its ring. But Jonathan talked about this movie when he was on the first time, and got back in touch with me and said, let's talk. And this is a good time too, as I said, because now we're mobile. We like a much larger audience than we ever had. And now, of course, there's this Kickstarter thing, that I haven't had a chance to really go into in a show or talk to anybody about, but I know a number of people who are involved in it. So we can learn a little bit more about this, and we can get people to send dollars. I think that's how it works. So pledges, you can tell us, and that's what we want to do so that we can promote that too. Tell us about the movie. You wrote the movie, and then tell us about how you found Kickstarter and how we're going to do that. I'm only going to interrupt you at the top of the hour, and then we'll come right back into it. So why don't you tell us all about that?
Okay, sure. Well, feel free to interrupt at any point if you have questions or whatever.
Yeah, that's it.
But, well, I've written a few movies, feature film screenplays, based on the characters of Trillo and Suede. It's a detective duo. Van Trillo is a detective and also a ventriloquist. His wooden sidekick is Sam Suede, so they're really a detective team because Trillo uses Suede in his investigations, particularly in interviewing and questioning suspects. He finds that by using the dummy, i.e. Suede, to do the interrogating, he can unnerve a suspect and distract them, disorient them in such a way that they tend to divulge information unwittingly willingly.
So inside the fiber of the character is the fact that he does this. It's not just a guy. We don't just have to accept right away that this is a detective with a dummy. You actually have it in the fiber of the character. There's a reason for this dummy.
Yes, absolutely. A detective who uses that ventriloquial skill in his detective work. It's an asset. So I think that's it opens up the door for many very intriguing storylines and story twists about how that affects the investigation. I have, as I said, a few screenplays, and that's another story in itself. I can briefly explain why I've written a few of them, even though I haven't gotten any of them produced yet, the full-length screenplays. I did produce a short film that a few years ago, Trillo and Suede film, so that is a done deal, and it is available to be watched on the internet for free. It's called Oxford Park, and if anyone wants to check it out, it's a 15-minute film. That was meant to be a demo for the Trillo and Suede characters, as a short film, as we were looking for ways to fund the feature films, the feature-length films. So Oxford Park, you can probably just Google it, Trillo and Suede, Oxford Park, my name, Jonathan Geffner, or you can just go to trilloandsuede.com and see it right there. Download it there and get a lot of information. So that's trilloandsuede.com spelled out. So getting back to the films, well, I wrote the first film I wrote was called Hong Kong Canary. That was back in 1999, and I had sort of shopped it around on the internet, early days of internet for me at least, and someone, there's a film director named Ian Lewis of Farnham Films in England who was interested in the pitch, and then I sent him the script. He loved the script, and so we formed a sort of partnership to try to get that produced. And we came close, and that for many reasons, a myriad of reasons, it seems like funding fell through or producers disappeared shortly before we were to shoot that film and several others. But that brings us, I'll fast forward now to this film, which is called While the Village Sleeps. And this is a film that takes place in England, mostly in rural England. It's sort of a parody of both Agatha Christie, the kind of old English inn, creepy English inns where mysterious murders always take place, and this is no exception. We've got a whole slew of murders that take place there. And Trillo is called there to investigate. Now, it's also a parody at the same time of film noir, because that's more of what my genre is that I've created here with the Trillo and Suede characters. It's kind of a Humphrey Bogart-influenced film noir detective, obviously American detective.
So it's out of the Dashiell Hammett genre.
Right, yes. But this is it's also a culture clash thing that's going on, which I think also adds a lot of interest to it and fun to the whole experience. The fact that we've got these sort of quintessential New York detectives here. Well, New York detective, the human one, with his wooden sidekick, in a British rural kind of environment, with a mix also of the clientele at the inn happens to be people from the noble class as well as lower classes, all mixed up for various reasons in the same inn. So we've got quite a mix and clash of both British society and, of course, the New York detective there trying to sort everything out before he gets killed himself. So I think there's a lot of elements going on there, which makes it a lot of fun and a lot of humor, a lot of very funny things happening there. But at the same time, not losing sight of the fact that it's a mystery with some fun plot twists, and I think some very surprising ones, especially a big twist at the end. And on its own merits, hopefully, people will agree that it's a really engaging mystery, along with the fun and the comedy.
Now, before you go into, let's just do the quick break here right now. There's Jonathan Geffner is I don't see any reason why not calling you world renowned, because you're anybody who can work for 28 years in any profession certainly is known by many, many people, even if he doesn't have a weekly sitcom. I got to tell you, there's a lot of people that Jonathan has performed for, in front of, and with, and whatever. So, he's here talking about any number of things concerning his in the world of entertainment and his ventriloquist and his movie. Now, and this is Cthulhu Chronicles, by the way. So we'll be giving you, get out your notebooks, write some stuff down, links, places to go afterwards, so you can do that. Now, Jonathan, before you go into anything else, let me ask you a little side question here about your influences in humor, as opposed to just the vaudevillian type stuff that goes on with ventriloquists and stuff. Who in the world of humor, I'm sure you grew up, I know now, I'm sure, I don't know how old, I don't know your age, but I know we're pretty much in the same generation, aren't we here?
Yes.
Okay. So tell me, humor, in your life, who has influenced the humor that you bring to the table with your ventriloquism?
Yeah, well, aside from Paul Winchell, who of course I talked about, but the Marx Brothers are my greatest influence, mm-hmm. I would say, as far as the comedians. I was a great fan of theirs. Aside from that, I've watched, I guess, a whole slew of various comedians from, I guess, the Golden Age, kind of Jack Benny and even Abbott and Costello and Jonathan Winters, great improv comedian.
So they're all media related influences.
Yes, yes. Of course, Woody Allen, a lot of very funny stuff that he, especially in the earlier years, his early films and his books, that he was influenced. So I guess there's a variety. I wouldn't pinpoint one thing as style.
Okay, well, but I think you made an important point, and that is they're all pretty much performing media, movies, TV, stage.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this would, of course, help. Assist. It would certainly seem obvious that you would bring all of that into a movie, as opposed to, it's just influence. I mean, I do a lot of writing, humor writing, based on influences of writers, is what I'm saying. Okay. And you picked the Marx Brothers first, which is fascinating to me, because there's, I always said and thought and looked into many of the things, having to do with them. And that is some of the most literate of, they're always considered the intellectual comedians, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So some of the most literate, and yet the TV, the movie influences, the movie, the stage play stuff, which nobody's seen, is certainly known by everyone. So you, and this is New York. You grew up in New York? Did you grow up in New York?
Yes, I did.
Where
right
did you?
Near where I live now. I grew up in Little Neck, Queens. Mm. It's on the border of Long Island, if people are familiar with the New York area. So it's within the New York City boundary, right on the border. And I live now in neighboring Great Neck, just a few blocks from where I grew up, actually.
So Little Neck, and Little Neck expands into Great Neck.
Yeah, it's like Great Neck is the promised land.
Great Neck.
Little Neck. So I reached the promised land. Great Neck is on the Long Island side of the border, so, which means that I'm not living in New York City anymore, technically, but I'm a few steps away from it.
It's right under Great Neck, of course, right under Big Head, New York, which would be the next step north.
Right, I'm sure. I'll find it someday.
Okay, don't worry. I won't be submitting any jokes for you. Okay, now let's go into this whole thing with Kickstarter.
Yeah, this is something that I was just made aware of recently. Somebody suggested to me I check it out because I kind of rewrote the script recently, or tweaked the script, I should say, to see how I could make it for a lower budget than it had required earlier, a few years ago when I first wrote it. So, and I came up with a version which in some ways I like even better, the lower budget one, because it somewhat changed the concept. I could get into that, but the bottom line is that I actually am very happy with the script in this lower budgeted form that I came up with, which just simply means that it would not require as much money to produce anymore. So we came up with a budget. I say we because I'm partnering with Ian Lewis, who I mentioned previously. He would be a co-producer and the director of this film, and he is very expert at bringing projects in under budgets and, you know, working within very tight budgets. So that's why I'm grateful to have him on the team, eager to do this with me. So we came up with a budget of $55,000 to be able to produce this movie over in England, and yet we do need to come up with investors, and this is a great way, it seems, to do it. A lot of people are doing low-budget movies like this. I mean, $55,000 is a lot of money out of my pocket at the moment, for example, but out of a lot of people's pockets. But it's very little money for a movie, for feature film, you know. So, in Kickstarter, what's great about it, it's not the usual way of people investing. This is just people who are made aware of a project. We have a promo video about the project and about the characters and the film descriptions, links to all kinds of information about the movie and so forth. And people who would like to take part in this to actually help make this movie come true, to have it produced, can become backers of the movie and get rewards for doing so. So it's not the usual way of investing. It's simply people who make a donation, they can pledge a donation through Kickstarter to our movie. And we have a deadline, now that it's up and running, the project is live, of June 30th to raise the $55,000 from individual backers. And people will get rewards based on their level of donation. They can, for as little as a donation of $10, they'll be able to get a download of the movie itself, before it's actually released, a pre-release sneak version of the movie. So that's for their $10 plus listed as a backer on the website. And it goes up from there. There the people with a little more, a little higher donation will get things like a copy of, autographed copy of the DVD, which I will personally autograph, autographed posters, T-shirts of the the movie production, up to Skype interviews with me and my dummies, an hour Skype interview chat with the puppets and me. Other goodies, other kind of rewards include being on set, invited to actually go to watch us shoot the movie. If it's convenient for you, you can get yourself over to England and chat with the actors. Also attend a cast party at the end of the shoot. Have me actually perform a show for you and your guests in your home, depending on where you live and your level of donation. So there are all kinds of rewards that we've come up with that we're offering, and depending on how much you feel you can contribute to our budget, you'll get commensurate rewards for doing so and help our movie come to life.
So this is basically how it works. Are there any other benefits for people? And I'm just asking this because I don't know. In terms of Kickstarter, I mean, if I say here's $1,000, can I invest it? Can I consider that an investment? Can I take it on my taxes? I mean, well, how does that, aside from rewards and things you get to be participating in the project? How do you get, what else can you do? I guess because the reason is this, why are so many people all of a sudden available to give money for other people's projects? I'm a little confused about this.
I think it happens when people are excited about a project, when something really grabs their interest, and they want to be part of it and feel part of it. You know, people who back our project will also be listed as backers, either on the website or for slightly higher donations, they'll be listed on the movie itself in the credits. Mm-hmm. For a certain level of donation, they'll be prominently listed as associate producer or even executive producer of the movie. So, you know, they get the satisfaction of being associated for posterity with the movie, as well as the chance to possibly even act in the movie for higher donation levels. You know, so there's a lot of possible rewards people can get depending on what they're comfortable with. And I say for even $10, you get to be listed on the website as one of our backers. You feel part of the team, and you'll know that you helped bring this movie to life and help change cinematic history, because, you know, this is a new genre we're creating here, Frank. This is dummy noir.
Dummy noir.
Dummy noir.
I don't know. Yeah, I guess in movies, yeah. Certainly, a dummy noir in radio. I'm definitely cornered that market a long time ago.
Well, I wouldn't want to intrude on your market. That's why we're carving out a different niche here.
But it's so fascinating to me because it just seems that I've been here since the internet began doing this, you know, at the big level, you know, Windows and cable and, you know, the big connection level. I was here before that, I just think it's amazing how no one thought of this before, because the whole idea of independent, you know, it started out with indie music. It was all independent music in the beginning, and now it's turned into independent film, and now ways for people to participate in projects that are like, you know, there are films and there are still albums. I know some people who are trying to fund their albums. What else do they do? Do people try and fund books?
On Kickstarter. Well, people can go to Kickstarter.com and just browse all the various kind of projects. People can put up almost anything that they need money for in order to fund, and they offer their own rewards categories and, you know, rewards levels. And depends if people feel that they'd like to go for it for any particular level. You know, you could check out mine. Well, when you go to Kickstarter.com, you just type in While the Village Sleeps, which is the name of our movie, and that will pop up. Or my name, Jonathan Geffner, and you'll see my project pop up, and you can check it out and see if that excites you like it excites me and the other people who are involved. It just launched about a week ago, and as I say, our deadline is June 30th. Every project has a deadline, so it doesn't just schlep on forever.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, there's a finite amount of time that we have to achieve the goal. Oh, and by the way, I want to point out something important here, because people always wonder if they're not familiar with Kickstarter. If we do not reach our goal by the date, by the deadline, which is June 30th, midnight June 30th, then no one will pay anything. So all people can do now, they cannot give us money right now. They can only pledge the donation. And if we reach our goal in pledges, then people will be asked to come forth with the actual donations, the actual money. So it's only if we reach our goal and we know that we are going to go forward and actually make this film, then people will be asked to donate that money that they pledged. But if we do not, then nobody will pay anything. So
I guess that's one way of weeding out the cheaters. Boy, there must be people out there trying to figure out how to work that system, huh?
Oh, yeah. Huh? Yeah, there are some other websites that are different. I heard about one. I don't want to mention names right now, that that does it the other way, that people just, if they don't, they put up a goal of whatever they want to say, but if people donate to them and they don't reach their goal, they still take the money and they can run with it or do whatever they want with it.
Well, is that how they make money then? You go into it knowing that, right? Is that the story?
Well, yeah, so I guess, you know, in a sense, it's perfectly legitimate as far as as long as it's up front. But I thought that this way is kind of, it's kind of a nicer way to do it, a better way to do it. Hopefully it will work this way, you know, that we're just saying, like, it's either all or nothing. Either, you know, we'll be able to do the movie, or we're not going to take your money.
Mm-hmm. And where, you want to say where you are now?
Where I physically am, I'm in Great Neck right now, near Little Neck.
Where's the Kickstarter, where the village sleeps now?
Well, we're just getting the words. These are the early days, so we've gone about 1 week into it. We've got $2,500 so far.
Oh, that's 10%. That's more than 10%. That's pretty good.
Oh, no, not yet, but we have to rev it up. So we're going to need to rev it up. As word gets out more in the next couple of weeks, that's what's going to really count, because hopefully this is going to start really spreading quickly now that we've gone past the initial stage, and that's what we'll need to do. We'll need to get the word out a lot more and have this ratcheted up so that we can get a kind of snowball effect, and that's what will need to be done.
$22,000 to make the film.
No, to $2,000 or $3,000. No, we're not. I wish.
No. I said your goal is 22, right?
No, the goal is 55.
Oh, 50. I'm sorry. Yeah. I don't know where I got 22.
Yeah, we do have a challenge.
So here. I was wrong. It's not 10%. Oh, I just had the numbers wrong.
That's okay. You know, it's going to be a challenge, but it can be done because, you know, word is just beginning to spread through social media and interviews like this. There'll be a couple of newspaper interviews coming out with me in the next week. So that's why I'm hopeful that it's going to start really picking up soon.
Let me ask you something in terms of budgeting, because I know people who work and budget actual, you know, million-dollar movies and stuff. And how on earth, if you're going to film this thing in England, we're talking about going over there? Or I mean, how built into this budget is the traveling and everything, right?
Yes. Yeah, well, as I say, a very tight budget.
Yeah.
We have, as I said, Ian, my partner here, is very skilled at bringing things under budget and working with tight budgets. But it's also because we have to do it on deferred payments for the actors and the crew. Mm-hmm. That's one part of doing it so cheap. So deferred payments meaning that we could only hire actors and crew who are willing to accept deferred payment,
sure,
not paid up front, but only when the movie starts making money. So they're taking a risk. Mm-hmm. It has to be people who are willing to take that risk because they believe in the project and they're eager to do it and to be involved. But we have to pay expenses. I mean, we have to feed our starving actors and our starving crew.
Right.
So once we find those starving actors and cast them and the crew members, just feeding them and paying for local transportation between sets and so forth, and props and incidentals. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of little things that come up.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Equipment rental, sure. I think, so that. So stuff like that, that's what's going to eat up $55,000 very quickly. If it's done the normal way, if everybody's paid their salaries up front, then it would have to be a lot higher. It would be over $200,000. Sure. That's still with just union scale.
Okay.
Yeah. That's how we'll need to proceed with it.
Did you write, when you said you rewrote this based on, we're talking, the whole noir thing is, the noir, actually the Dashiell Hammett stuff is all Los Angeles in Hollywood, that Hollywood, L.A. Confidential. I mean, it's not even New York, but it is America. Did you come up with that because of Ian and you decided you were going to do it over there or what?
Yeah, it was the latter. It was because this was a few years ago that he had some contacts there, some producers who expressed interest in one of my early scripts. I mentioned the first one I wrote, which took place in New York, Hong Kong Canary, oddly enough, the name is Hong Kong, but it takes place in New York. But they said that they need a script that takes place, is set in England in order to sell it to their market, in primary market in England. So I just wrote a new script rather than just trying to transplant it. I didn't want something that just doesn't work as well. I want something that really is intrinsic to the environment. So I wrote a new script to take place in England. Now, after I wrote it, the funding disappeared. One problem was the recession, and there are all kinds of problems that come up, and money comes and goes, but not at the right time so far for us. But in the meantime, I had the script that was set in England specifically. I tried to make it specific to fit there, to be something that works best in that particular setting. So there I had that script, and I mentioned that I rewrote it recently, well, tweaked it, I would say, not rewrote it drastically, but tweaked it to make it filmable on a lower budget. And I actually like it even better now. It's kind of sparser, leaner. It doesn't have as many locations, but it will have a bit of that kind of haunted house atmosphere about it, being primarily in one location in this old creepy country inn.
People are unaware of how much things are changed based on the financial support of movies. They don't realize that. And while when Hollywood had writers on payroll, that, you know, that kind of stuff would go on. They say, look, that's really, you know, it's really very good, but we need to have this guy, and we need to have this, or we have a way to save money in this particular location or what have you, and they do this. And this is why a lot of places double for places. There's a movie coming out that you talk about giant budgets, this World War Z, the Brad Pitt thing, that came from his production company and Paramount, who put a whole bunch of money into it, obviously. And there's a lot of it supposed to take place in New York. But for some reason or another, and that reason is always financial, okay?
Yeah.
It's Glasgow, Scotland.
Really?
Doubles for New York.
Now, that's a first that I've heard of, because it's known, widely known, that Toronto is sometimes used for New York, and then there's and Prague.
Yes.
Oddly enough, yeah, well, I'm sure you're aware of that,
sure.
Right? That Prague, there are parts of Prague that are used especially for old New York.
Sure.
But this is the first Glasgow. I didn't know that's being used.
It's all financial. It has to do with, the governments, how much money they give, and this, that, and the other thing, and where you get their equipment, and it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. People don't, we always accept when we watch movies, that's part of watching a movie, and just accepting the reality that they present.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it's done better than others. I'm sure you've probably seen movies that are supposed to be in New York, and you know, especially as a New Yorker, people usually recognize, or I've recognized, that this is not New York. We can tell it's somebody that's like, and a couple of times or more, I've seen movies that are set in New York, but I know it's Toronto. I mean, you can see this is definitely Toronto, you recognize. But I guess they go with the hope that most people won't know or won't care.
Well, they don't care. I think most people who go to a movie or want to watch a movie are place themselves in the reality that is presented. I mean, if that weren't the case, then let's face it, time and distance. I mean, look at movies, time and distance, and how, you know, we accept how that stuff works, and it's not real. Time doesn't work the same way in films or what have you. You know that when a clock is ticking. Did you ever count along with a clock?
actually, sometimes I have.
I did it in Goldfinger, because in Goldfinger, Bond is fighting Oddjob. And,
yeah.
he's attached to the nuclear bomb, and the clock is ticking down. If you get the beat of the clock, you should know, hey, you're a piano player, you got the beat. Get the beat of the clock, you know, so that it's going to end on 007 when he hits it. And I mean, it's got to be like three times, So but what I'm saying is that people accept, they just go into it, and I doubt if anybody, I don't think anybody sits there and goes, that's not New York. Come on.
Right. Well, I guess it also depends on how much you can suspend your disbelief about the rest of the film. If the film has really grabbed you, then you'll accept a lot of other stuff.
Well, yeah. Well, suspending belief is what it's all about. King Kong, in the original King Kong, changed sizes about 5 times.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So it's like, you know, suspended belief, we buy it. When when you did the script, when you wrote the script, is there only one dummy, or do you have other dummies popping up in this thing?
Oh, good question. There is one main one, of course, is Sam Swade. I don't know if I told the full names before. The names of these guys are Van Trillo and Sam Swade.
Right.
So Van Trillo, I think, is pretty obvious where I came up with that, but I thought it fits nicely because he's a ventriloquist. Hence Van Trillo, last name being Trillo. So Sam Swade, of course, Sam Spade, the famous detective.
That's a Dashiell Hammett.
Yes, right. Maltese Falcon of Humphrey Bogart fame. So
more dummies? Where are the other
more dummies? Yes. In this particular movie, While the Village Sleeps, there will be a couple of others. I have Aunt Sarah, who is an old lady puppet with a very distinctive personality, speaking with a Yiddish accent, and modeled very much on some people I've known.
Yeah.
Then we have Ezra, who I mentioned once before, who is a very whimsical kind of guy. So they have to they happen to be along there for the ride. The story opens with Van Trillo being in England temporarily, looking for his long-lost son, which is another kind of sub-story, but we don't get into it much. It's just part of the setup. So he happens to have been in England for 6 months or so. He started a relationship with a young woman named Chloe, who calls him as he's heading toward the airport, leaving to go back to New York. And she tells him that she is being stalked by an anonymous stalker who threatens to kill her. Plus, her mother has just died suspiciously, and she suspects foul play. And she's running off, trying to hide from her stalker. She runs off to this old country inn that she heard about, which is where most of the story then takes place. So Van makes a decision there. Should he stay? Questions himself. Should he stay and help Chloe, who is his old flame who he has just broken up with as he heads back to New York? Or should he just go ahead with his life and go back to New York? But he can't leave her in the lurch like that. So, of course, he heads to that isolated country inn himself, and they wind up being stranded there in the midst of a storm where people get murdered through the night, the various residents of the inn. Van, this all by way of explaining that Van, since he's heading back to New York, plans to go from the inn to the airport once this case is solved. He has 3 dummies with him because that's what he traveled the world with, and that's what he still has in his possession. So he's got all 3. He's got Sam Swade, his partner, and then he's got Aunt Sarah and Ezra, who he performs in clubs with on the side when he moonlights as the ventriloquist performer in nightclubs as well as doing detective work. So that's why he's got all 3 of those dummies with him. And it adds a lot of comic relief, the little interactions with those other 2 dummies too.
So, okay, so they're all his dummies though. You don't have any dummies as characters. It's him, as you said before, it's built into the fiber of his character that he's a ventriloquist and what have you, so that his dummies, it's not like you show up and one of the characters that is a dummy. You're not in that reality at all. They're all real people.
No, it's all his characters. In this this concept is more of a realistic one, in that the dummy, he operates the dummies. Now, there's another element here, good that you reminded me to mention it, in that another thing going on, which is that Trillo is beginning to suspect that his dummies are alive because they're talking without his help sometimes. So Trillo, though, is wondering, is it true or is he going mad? So as they try to survive the night, he and Chloe, who he's trying to protect from the unknown murderer who's in their midst, by the way, in the inn, and they don't know which one it is of the guests. So he's trying to solve this mystery while he also is being racked with questions about his own sanity.
Hmm. Okay. So we got, how long is this? Is this going to be a feature length? What?
Yeah, 90? Yeah, it's a good hour and a half.
90 minutes. Wow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And, we got a number of little subplots and stuff going on there.
Yeah. Oh, and let me mention, Frank, also the short film that I did a few years ago, the 15-minute film Oxford Park, which is a kind of demo for the series and in particular for this While the Village Sleeps. If people watch that, that concept is a little different because in that one, the dummies are presented as being alive, as autonomous creatures. That's okay. So it is a little different concept. But for this movie, the full-length movie, we're going with a more realistic concept, i.e. that Trillo is a ventriloquist. He is making these puppets talk. But he thinks they may be alive. They may be real.
Jonathan Geffner is real, and he is a ventriloquist, a professional ventriloquist. This means he actually gets paid for throwing his voice, friends. As you all know, when we use the word professional, we mean that you get paid for doing whatever it is you do. Jonathan has been doing this for years upon years upon years, and he is in New York, and we got a Kickstarter project going for his for a movie that he's written, and him and Ian, I forgot his last name.
Lewis.
I got to be Ian Lewis. Listen to me. Ian's. There's Ian's. You got to be. There's got to be. I know friends. I got people. Ian's. They're all Ian's. So how many Ian's are there in England? Many.
There are a lot of them.
How many Ian's does it take to screw in a light bulb? But Jonathan Geffner here on Cthulhu Chronicles, Y2K plus 13 here at, what is it? Where are we? We're at any number of places. And you can go and get some of these links. As you could write them down, as we told you, Jonathan, or you could go to the CthulhuChronicles.blogspot.com, and you can click on there, because I think we have a couple of his links in the description of this program. Plus, at the end of this show, within 30 minutes, it'll be on my Facebook page. So if you missed anything, go back, listen to it, download it, listen to it. And also listen to it as it pops up on any number of stations. That's what's good, too, Jonathan, is that this show is live now and will be rebroadcast throughout the entire week until the next one comes on. And then God knows what they do with that. Then it'll go around elsewhere other times, too, and be archived. So we hope to get a lot of coverage for Jonathan and pick up some bucks for you. I would love to see this film. Let me ask you a question. In terms of the history, and I know somewhat, I consider myself somewhat of an encyclopedia of various humor and things and movies and history, but
yes, I've heard that about you, Frank, by the way, that you are renowned as being, as having an encyclopedic knowledge of history of entertainers and entertainment industry and all that.
I seem to just know. It's one of those things I just pick up. And then when I was in the entertainment industry and I was actually, there and stuff, and I guess more of it just served me well. But here's what I don't know. I know of movies because I know Paul Winchell did and wasn't a very good movie. He did some other, some things that he didn't do. Movies. I know Edgar Bergen, of course, popped up in a lot of movies. I don't know about Senor Wences. What was his name? Wait, Senor Wences was the
he was the ventriloquist.
He had
Little Johnny was one puppet, and then
it's all right.
Who was that's all right. All right.
But I don't know. Do you know of any movies where ventriloquists had played a role that is anywhere near how you're presenting a ventriloquist, or you want to present him in this film?
No, I don't. Frankly, I don't.
Because I don't know.
So, that's why. I mean, it's possible someone's done a movie that I haven't heard of to that effect, right? But I don't know of any. As you say, there are quite a few movies from time to time that pop up that have a ventriloquist someplace in the movie, but not that it's the central character in such an intense way, with so much being kind of explored as to the character's character, and that the ventriloquist skill plays such an integral part of the plot and the whole concept. So, no, I do think I'm doing something here that's putting mm-hmm. things in a new direction, which is why I dub it Dummy Noir.
And it is remarkable that in this day and age, especially with there are any number of popular ventriloquists out there who people go to see. I know the names are going to Dunham. What's his name? Dunham?
Jeff Dunham.
Jeff Dunham. Yes. But, you know, these I don't know what you would call them. I guess they're contemporary. I just call contemporary ventriloquists. Who else is out there? Because you don't get as many ventriloquists as yet, like stand-up comedians.
No. Nowhere near that.
Who else is there? He just happens to be like, is he like the number one guy like right now? Or what?
He is. He's been that for a number of years now. I don't know, like,
Who else is out there?
There's Terry Fader. He's got a big reputation because a few years ago he won first prize in America's Got Talent. Mm-hmm. So that catapulted him to fame and a huge deal at, I think it's the Mirage Hotel, if I'm correct, in Las Vegas, one of those big hotels where he's had a stage show for the past 5 years. And yes, the two of them, Terry Fader and Jeff Dunham in particular, I think have raised the visibility of ventriloquism dramatically. Jeff Dunham, I think he still has a Comedy Central show, his own show, but he had HBO specials and he was a regular on many shows as a guest. So I think he probably still is the most famous ventriloquist in the world right now.
It's like, you know, it's like when you watch Comedy Central or wherever you see on television the, you know, comedy, stand-up comedy, there's two things you don't see a lot. And one of them is a ventriloquist just doing an actor. And the other one is teams. Teams, here and there are some teams, but you don't see comedy teams anymore.
Ah, yeah, well, that's where ventriloquism comes in.
Yeah, because that's it's kind of a team too. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot of talent out there. I mean, I have to say there are a number of ventriloquists who are very talented. you know, very good, not necessarily.
Where are they working? Things. Where are they working, these people that
we
don't know?
Well, comedy clubs, mm-hmm. there are different circuits there. Some of them are on cruises, and some people make a whole career of
yes.
being on cruises. You know, that's their specialty.
Yes.
And some of them do the college circuit, and some of them do the kids circuit. Excuse me, I'm mostly in that category myself. I decided to focus many years ago on being a kids ventriloquist and family ventriloquist, doing kids and family shows. I did adult shows. I did some comedy clubs and colleges and things like that, and I still do. I haven't done comedy clubs for a long time, but I still do adult parties and things like that. But I'm more known for kids and family shows. I just preferred that venue myself, those kinds of shows. My favorite venues of all are the family shows that are for all ages, because I love being able to perform on different levels at the same time, mm-hmm. doing a kind of humor that that can be appreciated simultaneously on different levels. But as far as the most ventriloquists who kind of have made it big are coming out of the comedy circuit, the comedy club circuit. That's what Jeff Dunham did and Terry Fader. So that seems to have lent itself toward getting more notoriety than the kids circuit. When I started off many years ago, I kind of had planned my career to be more like the Paul Winchell story, where he did mostly kid shows to start off and family shows. And his TV show was a kid or family kind of show, you know, not adult, really. So that was my model, but I think the timing was off for me, because in recent years, last couple of decades too, that has been thought of by TV producers, movie producers, ventriloquism has been thought of as kind of an obsolete art, whereas except if it comes out of that comedy club venue with a lot of foul language and stuff, and you know that, sure. that kind of stuff. Then they go, oh, this is cool. People are going, yeah, this is cool. Ventriloquism of curses, you know. So that seems to have gotten more. But not taking away, by the way, from Jeff Dunham or Terry Fader, they are excellent, and you know they, you know, I feel they deserve whatever they've achieved. But I'm saying that a lot of, I mean, it's just that going in that direction from the adult direction is the way that has lent itself to getting famous.
I see this wonderful picture that you have, I'm sure this was on your website or what have you, this picture of your dummies and then the person who's not a dummy. I guess that's your daughter. She's not 16 in that picture, though.
That's my younger daughter. That's on my website, right, the main page on my website, right. Mm-hmm. That's my younger daughter who is almost 13 now. That was taken 2.5 years ago, I think.
What comes to mind is how wonderful it must be, although I'm sure it has its drawbacks, to be the kind of a performer that you are in as professionally, and have a younger person, younger people around the house. Did you ever like pick up the laundry and make socks and do? I mean, how much did you perform for your kids? That is like that's almost a dream to have this perform.
You think so? You would think so. I would think so. And to some extent, that happened when they were little. I did take out the puppets fairly often and just kibitz with them, and you know they had a lot of fun. But I started when they were so young. That they were used to them, and they, you know, they used to think that they had extra brothers and sisters.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
But
right,
real. I mean, little weird. Kids, toddlers, just accept that they're real. So I don't know what point it dawned on them that these puppets are not real. Daddy's making them talk, but they got jaded, I suppose, fairly early on. So it wasn't such a big deal to them, like to other kids, you know, because. It's like they just kind of accepted it as reality. That okay, I've got other little friends in the house, and Daddy picks them up, and then they start talking. But it's not something that kind of wowed them anymore because they accepted that's just the way it is.
Was there ever a problem with it, like jealousy or anything?
Actually, yeah. Once in a while, sometimes if I pick them up too much, they would kind of say, "Daddy," you know, like I could sense that jealousy. Like I'm paying too much attention to them. That's true. It's funny. I think that's one of the reasons too. I kind of didn't stop doing it very often.
Yeah, having raised two boys and being a general nut job, it's amazing how they don't. You know, they see other. Kids and the other fathers, how they saw other fathers so different. They just couldn't, you know, it was so different. And yet I always thought, geez, I hope this is wonderful. I think this is wonderful. I'm just being myself and I'm doing what it is. And I think there's something special for these kids that long after I'm dead and buried, they'll say, hey, you know, my dad, you know, was this and that. And I think that's always a special thing. I'm not that it's bad to be like a math teacher and well, my father taught me calculus. I don't, you know, that's fine, but you know what I mean? And of course, and the kids tend to follow. Now you have two girls, but kids always are bonding many times as on a professional level with their father and mother. How did the girls? Do the girls fit into this show business or anything at all because this is what you do?
Well, yes. In fact, they're both very talented. And so I don't know how much genetics plays a role as opposed to the environment, too, growing up among creative things going on here. So probably both, I think, are factors. But my elder daughter, Michelle, is a very gifted singer and actress, or actor, I should say now.
I know, we got acting. Everybody's an actor.
Right. Yeah, so actor and singer. That's something that she wants to pursue professionally. And Sabrina is my younger daughter, who's a very talented flutist and dancer. She does ballroom dancing. So they're both performers and artists in various ways.
Well, what role do you think you played influencing them to be performers?
Yeah, I guess I assume that I had some influence, just the fact that they saw so many of my shows when they were young, and so they saw me up there on stage performing with my puppets. And then with the girls, as they were learning music, Michelle was as the singer, I started accompanying her when she performs. So, and now I'm her accompanist most of the time when she performs. I play the piano for her.
That's great.
So that's really nice. I mean, I get a lot of satisfaction out of doing that. It's very sweet thing for me to be able to perform with her.
Do you have an agent?
No, I don't. I'm listed with a few agents who occasionally call me for a gig of some sort, but that's not my main way of doing shows. It's mostly word of mouth, and so I find for the venues that I perform, which is mostly schools, private organizations, camps, festivals, fundraisers, you know, even private parties, that's mostly just word of mouth.
There are so many people out there who don't understand people like you and I who have been doing various forms of entertainment actually use the phrase word of mouth. Of course, today, I don't know people, younger people understand that, because it's like, you know, there's Twitter, there's Facebook, there's every other place you can go there, because of social media. Yeah. It's so different. But how has that helped or not helped your work situation?
It's hard for me to assess that. I'm not sure. It doesn't seem to have much impact for me, because when I say word of mouth, it's what I mean is referrals, personal referrals, repeat customers. I mean, people generally, I'm proud to say that usually if people hire me, they'll hire me again at some point. So, you know, so repeat customers plus customers mentioning me to other people, and people seeing me at shows and asking for my card, so that kind of thing. So that's kind of the old-fashioned way of referrals, is the way it works mostly for me. Now, people do occasionally hear about me and look me up on the internet or come across me. So it does happen sometimes. People call and say, I was looking for a ventriloquist. I Googled and I saw you and saw your clips and, you know, that kind of thing. So that happens sometimes, but I'd say not the majority of the bookings that I get. No,
well, I guess how many people out of the horde of people who hire entertainers wake up and go, you know, I'm looking for a ventriloquist.
Yeah. Well, I guess I do have those guys like Jeff Dunham to thank to some extent in that regard, because I think that probably has raised the consciousness a bit, to the extent that sometimes program directors, cultural arts directors, things like that, they will think like, what am I going to do for entertainment at the next event? And, hey, you know, maybe someone like Jeff Dunham. So I guess that does account for some of those Google searches. And in fact, there's one Google search which turned out very nice for me last year. Someone wound up hiring me to work on the movie Admission, which came out a few months ago. It starred Tina Fey.
Oh, yes, yes, I saw an ad.
Paul Rudd, and Nat Wolff as a teenage boy who's a ventriloquist. So they needed to find a ventriloquist to teach Nat Wolff, the actor, how to do ventriloquism in one scene there. He had to be able to pull it off that he actually looks like a ventriloquist. So someone was Googling, they were going to shoot in the New York area, so they're looking for a New York area ventriloquist. And I don't know how many they came up with, but they wound up hiring me to do it. So I trained Nat Wolff to do it. I was the ventriloquist advisor for the film. So if anyone has seen that film, I'm sure some of you have, and you'll probably recall where Nat Wolff, the character's name is Jeremiah, performs ventriloquism at a birthday party. And so I was the guy who trained him to do that.
You bring up this is the perfect segue. You didn't realize how you were providing this. But let's say we have a lot of younger people out there who are, although they're college people or they're going out into the world. But what if someone is listening to this and saying, ventriloquism, you always liked it, or this, that, and the other thing, or what have you. Where does someone who wants to begin and look at this, what do they read? Where do they look to find anything? Because I know that I still can't get the concept of making some of those sounds without moving lips and stuff. Where does somebody open up the book that tells them what to do?
These days, it's easier than it used to be. In fact, even when I started, it was before the internet. What I did was I sought out ventriloquists and watched them perform, went backstage, met them when I could, asked for tips personally, and if I was lucky, they'd give me some tips. I found out about ventriloquist conventions where I went and enrolled and saw ventriloquists give wet workshops and learned techniques that way. So it was a harder process, and mostly I learned through experimenting like crazy, just hours upon hours through the night watching myself on video. And in those days, it was VHS videos. So, I had a home camera and studying it and practicing incessantly. Now there's all that, all the above. Plus, there's the internet, and you can simply go on YouTube and you Google learn ventriloquism. Yeah. There are a number of people there who have videos showing you how to do it. Now, showing you, sort of the tricks is not exactly tricks. It's techniques.
Yeah.
But you it's out there now. It's not a secret. You can see all the techniques. Then it's your job to go practice them. But you can see people doing them and to varying degrees of efficiency. So you can be your own judge. You look at different people on the internet, on YouTube, and you can tell which ones look more convincing than the others. And you take the advice of the ones who look better. I haven't done that myself. I suppose I should do my own series, but there are people who are good. In particular, though, Paul Winchell himself, the great master who we talked about earlier, he actually produced a DVD shortly before he died, teaching ventriloquism, how to be a ventriloquist. And you can Google that on the internet. I don't think it's up on YouTube, but you can buy a copy on the internet from different places. And that is the best one that I've ever seen. So if you want to get the best instruction, short of going one-to-one with lessons, which I do, by the way, I do teach privately and sometimes classes in ventriloquism, but short of doing that, if you're going to learn through this other kind of not one-on-one basis, he has the best method, best methodology, the best tape. So look for Paul Winchell's DVD, How to Become a Ventriloquist.
I feel foolish because I'm always telling people this, that you just see just about everything on the internet. And last week, I had trouble with my cell phone and I couldn't open the back. I could not just take the back off and go into the, where the battery is located. And I couldn't do it. So I actually went to went to YouTube and I wrote in Samsung cell phone back cover, whatever it was.
Uh-huh.
And sure enough, there's a kid showing me how to take the cover off of it. And I'm always the one saying, there's just about everything you could want on YouTube. So I feel stupid thinking that, not realizing there must be ventriloquist lessons on YouTube.
Yeah, but, it's amazing, isn't it? How much is up there? There's almost anything you can think of now, someone has posted. So yeah, that includes ventriloquism. There are people teaching it.
Last like 10 minutes we have here? Do you know anything about the history of ventriloquism? I mean, does this go back to where does this? I mean, were the Egyptians doing it, or where did this originate? Do you know?
Well, I know there are sources that say that the ancient Greeks did it, then also the ancient Israelites did it, because there's something in the Bible about, I wish I remember now, shows my lack of biblical knowledge, but I forget the name of the character in the Bible who is said to, he's described as calling, standing in front of statues, and the statues come to life and talk in the name of God or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It is believed by many, and including me, suspected, I should say, that that person was doing ventriloquism. One of the priests, the ancient priest.
Mm-hmm.
Because it sounds very much like that, being a ventriloquist, the description of how he makes it sound like the voice is coming from from the statues makes me also believe that he was probably a ventriloquist.
I tend to look at the when you say the Greek, something clicks inside of me, because I know that if you know, look at classical literature, you know, there'd be no Shakespeare if there weren't for the Greek classics. You really go back to the Greeks, you really find a tremendous number of originating ideas and concepts and creative things come back to the Greeks, the classics. I mean, all of theater goes, right? I mean, they don't get a lot of credit for this. Now, when you say that, I'm going, yeah, I bet you there were Greek ventriloquists.
Yes, I have no doubt.
Yeah.
So it was used more, I think in those days, it was used more to trick people, people who figured out how to do it.
How would someone figure out how to do that, though? I mean, that's like, all of a sudden, someone, I guess it's the same thing, like, you know, I always say, like, you know, the guy who first got under a cow, and, you know, and squeezed the udder and said, hey, look, let's drink this and see what it's like. This is like a brave person who found out it was, you know, who figured out that, hey, that's what we do. That's what our ladies do with the kids. Why don't we drink this stuff? Same thing with stuff like ventriloquism and I'm always fascinated by roots in general. So I'm going like, who is this? Some guy standing around going, I wonder if, in whatever language he was saying it, I wonder if I could say the word particular without moving my lips? I mean,
Well, you know how it makes sense that both the I think it's a similar story from the Greeks and the Israelites. It was people of the priestly class who were making the gods talk to people, or presenting the gods as talking.
They were faking them, you're saying?
I think that was something born of necessity or born of opportunism, I'd say. That, you know, there's a reason they were thinking, like, hey, I can get a lot more money, a lot more contributions or something if I can have the gods request it, you know?
Very so
like,
good, that's
let's
right.
I can make my voice sound like that. I think through experimenting, they figured out how to do that.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And that's a brilliant thought to come to a conclusion. That's absolutely believable.
Yeah,
acceptable.
It's more in modern times that it became an art form purely for entertainment. You know, that dates to vaudeville. The vaudeville days, people.
Well, where'd the vaudeville guys get it from, though? There were cowboys, and there were, I mean, back before there was vaudeville, there were people making dummies and doing it too. You know what I mean? It's amazing
It seems like there's a big gap in history. There were always some people who were doing it, but it was much more informal. There wasn't a kind of formal venue or structure for how to use ventriloquism, but I'm sure there were always people who figured it out, and always a small number of people who passed it on from one generation to generation, but more of it's just a kind of like a novelty kind of thing, whereas when vaudeville came about, there were, I don't think anybody knows who the first person was who thought of it, but somebody apparently who knew how to do it figured, hey, you know, I can make a puppet and make it talk, and it will be funny. I'll use ventriloquism, and then it caught on like wildfire.
Yeah, it's brought from overseas. Recently, I watched again the movie Chaplin with Robert Downey Jr. Have you ever seen that?
No, I have. I missed it.
Well, you'll catch it again, because now we know we can see anything we want to. And what was great about that was how here's Chaplin, who became the king of American cinema, this new industry, this new thing, what he brought over that nobody had here was this sense of British theater comedy. And when he brought it over, even though there was slapstick and stuff here, he brought over this unique, sense of it with character and everything. And, I guess the same thing happened with lots of stuff with certain music, which came over from Europe, because I mean, what's America? I mean, we just grabbed things and turned it into stuff because people brought it over here. It was going on before, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's Chaplin doing that. I guess ventriloquism might've been the same thing. There might've been ventriloquists in Shakespeare time too. I mean, these guys might have been doing this stuff and then they were puppets, right? So it's just it's really kind of now I just thought of this, see?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, because there were guys who had puppets and there were string puppets and they would move their lips. Maybe somebody just said, hey, what if I could hold this thing and talk?
and not move my lips, right? And create the sound as if it comes from a different place. It just somehow I'm sure people did it, but it didn't become known as a format until vaudeville. Then all of a sudden, for some reason, it caught on as a popular way to do it.
Last week we were talking about old television shows, and we happened to bring up a guy who we laughed about tremendously, and we didn't mean to laugh at him, but there was this guy on New York television, you might have seen him, he did Terry Toon Circus, this guy called Claude Kirshner. Do you remember Claude Kirshner?
No, I don't recall the name.
Okay, and the funny thing about Claude Kirshner was he had a puppet, and he was on screen, and they played cartoons, and it was Terry Toon Circus, so he was dressed like the, you know, the guy, the master, the whatever they call him, the ringmaster. And he had this, this hand clown, and you know, who he so creatively called Clowny. And what was really funny about him to everybody was that he was the worst ventriloquist in the world. They wouldn't even take the camera away from him. He would talk in a voice that was just him doing high, and you would see his mouth moving like everything.
Like he wasn't really attempting to be a ventriloquist, or it would be better if he was attempting it and he wasn't doing it. But a lot of people, they just move their mouth, so you know they're not really attempting it.
So have you seen? And you know, I don't want you to name names or anything like that. But I mean, have you been out on the road seeing people who've done just say, "Here's my puppet," and just don't do it? I mean, they just do it, and it's what? I mean, are there bad guys out there and girls?
Yeah, I haven't seen that. What I have seen and what is embarrassing is when people present themselves as ventriloquists, but they're really bad at it.
You know?
I figured that's when it always seems like, well, just don't call yourself a ventriloquist, and it won't be embarrassing anymore. I've got a puppet, and just watch the puppet because I move my mouth and forget about me. Fine. You know?
Well, quickly, since we're running out of time, before I want to get back to reviewing all the stuff, what about women? I can't name one woman ventriloquist. Do you know anyone?
Shari Lewis.
Of course!
Goodness.
That's stupid of me. That's really stupid. Yeah, I'm an encyclopedia, right? And I remember, Lamb Chop.
Make a little asterisk next to ventriloquism. You've got to fill in that part of your encyclopedic brain.
I know her. Of course I know her. I mean, from the... Yeah, I just didn't... But yeah. I guess I was... You know why? I was thinking mostly now.
Right. Currently.
Contemporary. Right. I don't know.
Anymore, but she was...
and you can't name a lot of them besides...
Ventriloquist. Yes, and... she also... I watched her when I was a kid on TV. She wasn't the influence on me, on my style, as was Paul Winchell, of course, but she was a wonderful ventriloquist. Yeah. Right now there are Nina Conti, a British ventriloquist. Okay. She is also an excellent ventriloquist, and she's become quite big. She's very popular now, Nina Conti.
Let's get all this stuff together again here now, but as we're in the last minute, and we need to put this together. Kickstarter, give them all the links right now.
Yes, go to Kickstarter.com, and you find my project by then doing a little search for either my name, Jonathan Geffner, or While the Village Sleeps, which is the name of my movie project. And you'll see it pop up there, and you can get all the details. It'll tell you right there how you could become a backer, which means pledging a donation of any amount you want. We gratefully accept anything from $1 and up. But from $10 and up, you begin to get rewards of various kinds, starting with a free download of the movie and going up to your own autographed DVD copy, which I will autograph personally, as well as autographed posters, T-shirts, opportunities to even appear in the movie as an extra for higher donation levels and various other goodies and reward levels. So check it all out and
get on over there.
Hopefully you're comfortable with that. And we're only asking for pledges of donations now. You'll see how it works there. It tells you how to do that. If we reach our goal, our finance goal, by June 30th, which is our deadline, we've got to reach the $55,000 mark of pledges. then all the backers will be asked to fulfill their pledges by donating the money, and then they'll be getting their rewards and being kept up to date on the progress of the film, behind the scenes video access, and all kinds of stuff.
Okay, and Jonathan will come back. We'll come back and see how it's doing. I'm rapidly running out of time here, but thank you. We'll come back, Jonathan. You'll come back and tell us what's going on, and we'll follow the.
Sure, I'd love to.
Okay.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun, Frank.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being with us here tonight, and we'll talk to you soon. Okay.
Great. Okay. Take care.
Thank you, Jonathan. Jonathan Geffner. Oh boy, we did a great deal. Then was that great? There we go. Oh, we're on our way out of here now. My name is Frank. It's all in the minute's name. It joins the title of the show. Thank you very much, Jonathan, and everyone else who listened. And go to the CotoloChronicles.blogspot.com and click. You can get to the Kickstarter. Jonathan Trillo and Suede there, and his website. Hire him. Do stuff. Everybody support one another, because that's what we got to do. Okay. Good night, Mrs. Ernst Weil, wherever you are. We'll be back again next time, next week. Here, stay with us on your iPhones and your e-phones and everything else like that. I got to go now. I got nothing more to say.